Hello and welcome to the 7th series podcast, where we talk about Ashtanga yoga and family life. The show is produced in Melbourne, Australia by me, your host, Gaynor Stanisic.
Hello and thanks for joining me. In this episode, I speak with Germana Saber. She's an authorised Ashtanga yoga teacher living in Dubai. Germana is currently pregnant with her second child. In this episode, she shares her journey with pregnancy and also the birth of her daughter, Tara. During the birth of her daughter, Tara, Germana had a doula and had planned a water birth. After 26 hours of labour, when her waters were broken, meconium was discovered and her birth took a different direction. Germana shares her journey after the birth, experiencing postpartum depression and processing a traumatic birth. It was 18 months before she was able to acknowledge how she was feeling. Germana is also a vegan and raises her daughter as a vegan too. I hope you enjoy this episode.
Hi, thanks for joining me today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself, where you live, who's in your family and what you do?
Of course. So my name is Germana and I live in Dubai in the UAE in the Middle East, and it is a gorgeous, gorgeous city. I was actually born and raised here, but I'm not from here. I am originally Greek-Lebanese, so quite multicultural in this very diverse city. I have a daughter who is 3.5, and I am currently pregnant with our second daughter as well, due in November. My whole family lives here, actually. My parents-in-law and my sister and brothers-in-law. My brother lives here. My parents live here. So it's really nice to have family around. And even though I'm not from here, this is very much home. Of course, I have my husband and we have a beautiful rescue dog as well.
And what do you do?
At the moment, I have a full-time job with a business called Virgin Mobile, and I'm part of the marketing team there. I joined them about 8 or 9 months ago. Before that, I was a full-time yoga teacher for about 10 years in Dubai.
What the career change?
It's funny because people, you know, leave the corporate world to teach yoga. I left the yoga world to join the corporate forces again.
Tell us a little bit about how you first came to Ashtanga yoga.
I was studying in Montreal, attending university, and I had already been there for a few years. And I lived downtown, so there was a very popular shala there that was run by certified teachers Mark and Joanne Darby. They were Patabi Joyce's direct students in the 70s and early 80s. And I never made much of it. I knew very little about yoga, and whatever I did know was from movies, and it would just be people sitting doing some makeshift mudra and chanting om, and that was my idea of yoga. Until one day, a neighbor told me that she started going to yoga classes at her local gym and highly recommended it, that it was a great way to complement her workouts. So I got a little interested because I had been going to the gym quite regularly and I had a very unhealthy relationship with the gym because I basically treated my body like it was something that I had to torment so that I can get it into shape or anything like that. So that wasn't the best way to live. And I started to think, what if I tried something else and that would help me on a physical level? But then I actually ignored that feeling until one day I got sick and I was hospitalized and found out that I had an ovarian cyst that grew and burst. And that started to make me think, okay, what does my lifestyle have anything to do with whatever's happening internally? Is it my mental state? Is it how I eat? Is it how I move? Is it the fact that I smoke? And I just started to question everything. And then a friend of mine told me that she also had similar problems and highly recommended yoga as a holistic approach. And that's basically how I decided to try a class. And I walked in, it was September 2009, I believe. And I did lead primary on a Sunday morning. And that was crazy. It was a very difficult 90-minute class. And it completely changed my perception of yoga from a physical aspect. I didn't think that it would be so tiring. I didn't think that it would require a lot of strength. And I didn't focus too much on the mobility and the flexibility side of the physical practice, but I was really blown away by how much strength you need in a practice like Ashtanga. And I don't know what it was. We were lying down taking rest and the teacher who was teaching the class played a song. And that song made me cry. And I just felt like I needed to keep coming back to understand why a physical practice made me feel so emotional. And that's how I pretty much started.
Have you taken trips to Mysore?
I have, yes. I took my first trip in 2012, and it was after I moved back to Dubai, which was great because it's just a 3 or 4 hour flight from here to Bangalore and then a few hours by car. And I've made several, I believe, 5 trips, if I'm not miscounting, since then.
And what led you to teaching yoga?
When I moved back to Dubai in 2010, there was only, I think, 1 or 2 places that offered yoga classes. And I missed being part of a community. And I couldn't find a traditional Mysore program. I couldn't even find any classes that I was interested in taking that were anything but Ashtanga yoga. So then I came across a teacher training course that a teacher was offering here in Fitness First. And I figured that I would join it just so that I could be part of a community. I had no interest in teaching. I was starting my career as a videographer, and that was what I wanted to do as a way of making money. I joined the teacher training, and it was a 6-month long program. And 1 month into it, the person who's running the course tells me, listen, I need you to cover a few classes. And I said to her, absolutely not. I'm not ready. And I don't want to teach. But she kept pushing and encouraging. And then I just went ahead and covered one class. And I caught the bug. I loved teaching. I loved the response that I got from people. They weren't expecting an Ashtanga class, but it ended up being that for them. And they were very curious as to what that was all about. And, you know, I would always speak about Patabi Joyce, the tradition, the vinyasa system, just try to bring in as much knowledge and information into the sessions before we start and get people a little bit more interested. Because I guess in a way, I had an agenda to build some kind of a community that was already missing here. And they just kept asking me to come back to cover classes. So I started to teach yoga part-time in addition to having a full-time job for about 2-3 years before I decided to go full-time teaching.
And then at some point you opened your studio.
Yes, I went to Mysore in 2012. Yusuf, who's my husband now, was my boyfriend at the time, came with me for the first 10 days. And we were both just in La La Land in Mysore. You know, when it's your first time there, you're just completely in love with how easy life is there, how laid back everyone is, how different it was from the hustle and bustle of Dubai. And we just started to dream and think, you know, what is it that we really wanted to do with our lives? If we were to follow our dreams and turn our passion into our jobs, then what would that look like? And he would say, oh, I would really love to open a restaurant one day. And I would say, I'd really love to open a yoga studio one day. Then he went back to Dubai and I stayed back in Mysore to complete the month. And then when I returned, he needed to have surgery, nothing life-threatening. And when he woke up from surgery, the first thing he said, at that point, we were just looking at places that we can rent to maybe potentially open up a yoga studio. And we were shown 2 spaces. And the real estate agent told us that these 2 spaces are owned by the same landlord. So maybe I can get you guys a really good deal if you own both of them. And we were just thinking, let's look into opening a yoga studio with no plans in mind immediately. But then he woke up from surgery and he said, give me the phone. I want to call the real estate agent and make an offer. And I didn't understand what was going on. So we kind of acted out of a whim. And we started the whole building process for the yoga studio and the restaurant that Yusuf owned in June 2012.
Did you plan to have a family?
I have always wanted a family. And I met Yusuf when I was young. I met him when I was 18. And at that point, I didn't think that that would be the person that I would spend the rest of my life with because I was still young. And I thought that maybe I had to kiss a few frogs before I found Prince Charming. But little did I know. And as the years passed and our relationship grew and, you know, it became very clear that we were going to be in each other's lives for a very long time. At some point, and I think it was after we opened the yoga studio, that I started to think, okay, I think it's time that we take the next step, get engaged, get married, have kids. Now, Yusuf and I both come from Middle Eastern Mediterranean backgrounds. His family is a bit more conservative than mine, but still being part of a Lebanese family myself, it would have been very difficult to start a family without at first getting married. So I knew that there were certain steps that we needed to take. We opened the yoga studio, check, move on. Okay, Yusuf, now it's time for the parents to meet. Then we got to get engaged. Then we got to get married. Then we can have kids. So it was almost like, you know, these stairs that you had to climb to get to your destination, which is a very weird way to think about it because that's not how him and I necessarily think. We always knew that we wanted to be together. I wanted to start a family. He really didn't. It was not like a priority of his or anything like that. But then when the time was right, we were married for a year and we were celebrating our anniversary. Just out of nowhere, he looks at me and he says, I think I'm ready to start a family. And so it was great that we're both on the same page. And then we conceived Tida.
And was that an easy journey for you, or were there any challenges in conceiving?
Not at all. I was worried that that would be the case considering the health scare that I had with the cyst. And so that's one of the reasons why after being married for just a year, I was kind of on a mission to convince Yusuf that it's time we need to start trying. And I remember using words such as, we're not getting any younger, it's going to be more difficult. If I'm in my 30s, I might struggle, I might have a miscarriage. It could take us 6 months to a year to get pregnant, which is why we should start trying. I kept saying all these things to try to convince him that it was time to start. And I was also worried because, as I mentioned, he had surgery when we came back from Mysore, and it had to do with his chances of conceiving. So I was really, really worried that we wouldn't be able to conceive quickly. And I don't know if this is too much information, but all it took was one try.
Tell us a little bit about what it's like in Dubai. What were your expectations when you were planning where you would have your baby, and what kind of preparation did you do?
So the first thing I did when I found out I was pregnant was decide to sell the yoga room and close down the business. We had had the yoga room for about 4 years, and it became a huge source of stress, both emotional stress and financial stress as well. And that was not how I wanted to go through my pregnancy journey, because at that point, I didn't know if I was going to be able to have any more kids. I was just feeling very lucky and blessed to be pregnant with the one. And I wanted to make sure that I enjoyed it and did it properly without any stress. So that's what that was the first, I would say, preparation that I took. And thankfully, it only took a couple months to get that sorted. I kept practicing. I wasn't able to practice throughout the first trimester. I had severe sickness, all-day sickness, not just morning sickness, and nausea. And it lasted the whole first trimester. And I remember after hitting the 13th week mark, I was able to go back to practice. And that was really helpful. I was planning for a natural water birth. And so I ended up hiring a doula and, you know, just reading Ina Mae Gaskin books or listening to interviews, watching her documentary, watching YouTube videos of women giving birth in all different scenarios in all different parts of the world. In Dubai, we don't have birth centers like some places in the world. We just have the hospital and you see a gynecologist for your appointments, not a midwife. But what's funny is that when you actually go into labor, your gynecologist is not with you. It's whoever midwife is on duty. And the doctor only comes in case of a medical emergency or at the very last minute when it's time to push if the doctor is available. So I had my doula thinking, you know what, if the doctor doesn't come, at least I have this woman who's experienced. She's given birth twice. She's worked with a lot of families. So she would help me out through labor and maybe just give me the emotional support that I also needed when it was time to push. But unfortunately, or maybe I say unfortunately a lot, but I have to learn to stop saying that. It ended up in a C-section.
So tell us about your pregnancy. You mentioned that you were sick in your first trimester. How was the rest of your pregnancy?
It was amazing. It was very easy. I was able to continue teaching Mysore programs and led classes to private students. As I said, I could practice. I didn't have any food aversions anymore. During my first pregnancy, I was a vegetarian. So I had an insane craving for eggs and cheese, and I ate a lot of that. And otherwise, it was just a really nice time. I enjoyed being pregnant. I enjoyed having family around. I was in a much better emotional state with not having to worry about the yoga studio or the number of people attending classes or how much money we made that day, that week, that month. So it was quite pleasant. Not necessarily the case with the second baby. So now I'm pregnant, and with coronavirus happening, I've been working from home since March. But that's quite stressful because one of the main reasons I decided to get an office job was to be surrounded by people. I found being a yoga teacher quite lonely, and I quite like being around people and having a team and working with people. I still have nausea. I'm already in my second trimester, and I still have nausea. I feel heavier than I did in my second trimester with my first child, in my first pregnancy. I'm unable to practice on a daily basis. I would say if I'm lucky, I would get in 4 days a week of asana. That's what's been happening.
Tell us about your yoga practice when you've been pregnant what modifications you've done and how have you navigated practicing when you're pregnant? Have you had guidance from a particular teacher?
During my first pregnancy, I think it was right before I got pregnant, I started to read Yoga Sadhana for Mothers, reading all the interviews and just kind of trying to relate to as many stories as possible and figure out, okay, so this is what Harmony did during her pregnancy. This is what Joanne Darby did during her pregnancy. I think I can relate more to what Harmony did than Joanne, because Pattabhi Joyce made Joanne do some really crazy things during her pregnancy. And I just tried to figure out what would work. When I had the yoga room, we did have a lot of pregnant women come in. And at the yoga room, there was always an authorized teacher around to run the program. And I would assist the authorized teacher. And I got to observe how they taught pregnant women, what modifications were given. So, you know, the basic things, don't twist inwards, do everything with your feet spread apart, take out shoulder stand. If you're comfortable to do headstand, great. Maybe do it against the wall. And I would take it day by day. And that's what I did with the first pregnancy. I was doing just primary, modified primary, staying in poses a little bit longer, modifying chaturanga if I needed, doing 5 sun salutations A and 2 B if I wanted, not bothering with 3 or just whatever felt good that day. And I think I managed to continue practicing up until 38 weeks of pregnancy. And then I just felt really heavy. I had pelvic girdle pain as well. Nothing felt good anymore. I just wanted to give birth. I didn't want to be pregnant anymore. With the second pregnancy, so my practice progressed over the last few years and I started to do some asanas from second series. And so now in the second pregnancy, I've been adding in, I wouldn't even call them poses from the second series because they're insanely modified. For example, instead of doing shalabhasana, I'm doing cat-cow spine movements and, you know, just lifting the leg up, trying to get some kind of length and arch in the back. I do a modified ustrasana. Instead of Kranchasana, I'm doing, what's the name of the pose that comes later on in second series where it looks like a twisted Janushirshasana? Parigrasana, if I'm not mistaken. Doing what I can. There's a teacher here that runs a Mysore program. Her name is Natalie Dau. I'm mainly a home practitioner. In Dubai, I didn't really practice with teachers. When I had the yoga room, whoever was the authorized teacher, then I practiced with that teacher in the studio. But my main teachers are all international teachers, people that I learn from and kind of resort to for some advice. But, you know, you learn from everyone. You can even learn from students that come to your classes. Natalie, I think, is an amazing teacher, and she offers a safe space for me to practice in, which is great. I'm managing to go there once or twice a week. And it's just really nice to be around her because she gives some really nice adjustments. She's not pregnant. She's not a mom. But she still has some insane knowledge over how you can modify the practice, which is really nice. So she's been introducing a few things into my practice that's been helping. So just kind of having fun with it. What I also noticed with pregnancy is that what flies out the window is this need to stick to the strict sequencing of Ashtanga. Obviously, you have to eliminate some poses, you have to modify some poses, and you can even add some poses that are not part of the Ashtanga system or are not even yoga poses. But they help. If they make you feel good, then why not?
What did your practice look like before you were pregnant?
So my last trip to Mysore was last year in March, and Sharath moved me up to Kapotasana. So I was doing that with him. So I have a teacher in Greece. I have a teacher in, obviously, in Mysore. And Darby is my first teacher and will always be someone that I go to. So these are three main teachers that I kind of work with. And so my teacher in Greece gave me up to Bakasana B. That's where I was practicing up to before I got pregnant. With the day I found out that I was pregnant this time around, the first couple of weeks, I would say, before nausea kicked in, I was able to continue practicing. And at that point, you know, I had just found out that I was pregnant. So the pregnancy test said 1 to 2 weeks because I took a test quite early on. I kind of had a feeling that I was pregnant. And I didn't modify yet. The modifications only happened when I came back to the practice after taking the first trimester off.
And then how did your practice change through the second and third trimesters?
With Tara, I stopped doing headstand in the third trimester. I stopped doing back bends in the third trimester as well. So Urdhva Dhanurasana didn't feel good anymore. I still managed to do Urdhva Dhanurasana in second trimester. But with my first pregnancy, I was not comfortable with dropbacks, even if they were assisted dropbacks. However, now with my second pregnancy, I'm now 19 weeks, and I'm managing to do assisted drop backs with Natalie when I go see her for practice. And what I've been doing otherwise, because I'm not naturally bendy and back bends don't come to me easily. So because I don't want to, you know, take any risks, hurt myself, fall on my head, or even just have any back pain, what I've been doing when I'm not with Natalie is just walking down the wall and walking back up. And that's my drop back practice.
And then you said that you experienced some pelvic girdle pain. Mm-hmm. What does that feel like? And how did you find out that that's what it was?
So I carried most of my pregnancy weight in my baby bump. And I have a tiny frame. My husband is very tall and my daughter takes after him. So she's already half my height and she's 3.5. So she's really tall and a very healthy, beautiful baby. And I'm guessing that when I carried her in my belly, she was, and this is what my gynecologist has told me recently, is that while she was within the average range, she was 3.5 kilos, she was a big baby for my frame. And apparently I don't have childbearing hips. My hips are small and they didn't grow with the pregnancy. So what happened was all her weight was dumping down into my pelvis. And so there was a lot of pain around the groin and in my pelvic floor. And it was really difficult to walk. You already waddle when you're pregnant anyway, but it was just so painful to walk, so painful to sit. No position felt comfortable. Nothing that I could, the only thing that did feel good was swimming because it, you know, helped me feel lightweight. And that's what it was. It was very painful.
Is it the pubis bone rubs together, like it's the two bones rubbing?
I think so. I'm not quite sure. My gynecologist, you know, you try to get words out of her, and she's just a really busy doctor. She doesn't, and this is something that I'm struggling with the medical system here, and that's why I really wanted to maybe work with midwives. I get very little information out of my doctor, and she's quite dismissive as well. So when I told her, listen, I'm experiencing pain and it hurts when I walk, she just looked at me. She said, you've got pelvic girdle pain, pelvic girdle syndrome. And that was that. She said, it will go away after you give birth. Literally, that's what she said to me. It's like, okay, guess it's just something I'm going to have to live with for a few more weeks.
What were the first signs of your labor?
I went over my due date by 5 days. And over here, it's very common for doctors to induce women at 38 weeks because they believe 38 weeks, your pregnancy is complete. We don't have to wait any longer. And as a matter of fact, if your pregnancy goes on any longer, then it's a higher risk on the baby. My doctor was a bit more pro-natural and she was quite understanding of the fact that if there are any unnecessary medical interventions, then that could lead to a C-section. And I was doing everything that I could to avoid that. So I had my appointment at 40 weeks and she said, you're not dilated at all. We're just going to need to keep checking you for the next week, every other day to see how you progress. I went to my third appointment with her after my 40-week mark and she said, listen, you're not progressing and I don't feel comfortable letting you go over 41 weeks. So if you don't go into labor naturally by 41 week mark, then I'm going to have to induce you chemically, which is something that I really didn't want because I knew that that kind of medical intervention was going to more likely have me in a C-section. And I didn't want that. So then I spoke with my doula and I told her, listen, this is what's happening. What can I do to induce naturally? And obviously there's the usual, make sure you're drinking red raspberry tea leaf, take evening primrose oil up the hoo-ha. That's one thing that someone told me. Get busy with your partner, which I mean, when you're 9 months pregnant, I don't think either of you really want to do that. Walk around, you know, and I tried a lot of these things and they didn't work. And then she said, how about you get acupuncture done? Here's the name of a lady called Dr. Ooh, give her a call. She'll come to you and she'll sort you out. So I literally called her, booked the appointment for the next day. She came, inserted needles in a couple of places. It was a 20-minute session. Looked at me and she said, you're going to go into labor tomorrow. And luckily I had an appointment with my doctor scheduled for the next day. So I went and I was feeling some period-like cramps in the lower belly. When they were checking me before I got to see my doctor, the nurse was checking me. She said, do you feel any pain? I said, what kind of, like period pains? And she said, yeah, you're having irregular contractions. You're in inactive labor. And I was like, great, fantastic. And then I saw my doctor and you know, we were both happy with the progress, I suppose, that I made. And she said, I'm just going to give you a quick membrane sweep because you're only 1 centimeter dilated and this will speed the process up. And I figured membrane sweep, like how bad can that be? And that's what I did. And then from there, labor progressed quite quickly. 3 hours later, I was having some really intense contractions. And I met up with a friend, walked around the park to try to speed things up. But from that point onwards, I labored for 26 hours before I delivered Tara.
And were your contractions regular through that 26 hours, or did labor sort of stall or fizzle out throughout that 26 hours?
They were quite regular and they were very intense. I managed to take a shower. I managed to drive myself back home, which was crazy. Shouldn't have done that. Got stuck in traffic for about 20 minutes. I managed to get some food and I managed to sleep for about 3 hours. And then I woke up in the middle of the night and I woke my husband up and I said, I think it's time to call the doula. And she came and I labored at home all through the night until it was about 4:30 in the morning. I went to the hospital. They checked me and they said, you haven't made much progress. You're just 2 centimeters. Go back home, labor there for a few more hours and then come back. Even though the contractions were quite close to one another and they were lasting for very short periods. So it was just like no break whatsoever. Then finally, I went back to the hospital in the afternoon at around 2 p.m. And they checked me and they said that you're 6 centimeters dilated. You can go into the pool because, as I said, I wanted a water birth. And they filled the tub up and I wanted to get in the pool because in my mind, I knew and I thought that once my body hits the water, I'm going to completely relax and it's going to be a huge pain relief for me, which really was the case. The minute my toes touched the water, I mentally relaxed and I even felt my shoulders drop down. You know, they had the mood lights in the hospital on. I had Ben Harper playing in the background. My mother was there. My husband was there. My doula was there. My dad was there. And then at some point, my mother and sister-in-law walked in as well. They stayed for 2 minutes because they couldn't handle it. So I was having a pool party in the hospital. But that's when labor slowed down. I reached 9 centimeters because I was way too relaxed. And I remember the midwife checking me saying, okay, you're 9 centimeters. I think it will be about 45 minutes before you're ready to start pushing. And then she says, I'm just going to go grab lunch and come back. I won't be long. I didn't make much of it. And I figured, you know, I have my doula and I have my mom and husband around, then I should be fine as long as I'm not left alone. But she was gone for an hour and a half. And I have pictures of me sitting by the edge of the pool, just kind of waiting for something to happen. At that point, I didn't have any contractions at all. And then the midwife came back and my mother made a huge fuss about it because my mother, I think, was a bit skeptical about the whole laboring and delivering in water. That was a very new concept to her. Then, so the midwife checked me. She said, okay, we need to break your waters. Let's see what's going on. The minute they pulled me out of the water, the contractions came back and I felt like someone was shooting me with a machine gun nonstop. I laid down on the bed. They broke my waters. They found meconium. The midwife panicked. My doctor was not in the hospital. She was not on duty. It was her day off. So they had to call her to come in. And it was rush hours. So it took her a while to come. And because of the meconium and because of the position that Tara was in, the doctor looked at me and she said, you know what we need to do at this point, right? I just need your consent. And that's how it happened that I ended up in a C-section.
How did you feel about that in that moment?
Like a total failure. I was very sad. I was very angry. I couldn't believe that I endured all that pain to then end up in a C-section. I couldn't believe that I also, you know, I was thinking all kinds of crazy things, things that in my normal state I wouldn't think. I was thinking things like, I can't believe I hired a doula and spent that money for nothing. So just crazy things like that, that were very dark thoughts as well. And I just was unhappy with how it ended up. And the way the doctor positioned it is that, look, you know, if you didn't want to rush into a C-section and you want to wait, I'll give you another half an hour, but that's a risk that you're going to have to take. Obviously, when your doctor tells you that you're risking your child's life, and I don't know what kind of a risk it would have had in my life, but I was more concerned over my child. It was very easy for me to not even think about it and say, yes, let's get this baby out as quickly as possible. I was also disappointed in the fact that my doctor wasn't around. I feel that if she was there, then we could have done something about it. If she knew that the baby was not in the right position, we could have done something to change that. Or maybe I could have just ended up in a C-section much earlier and not go through transition pain from 7 to 9 centimeters.
And so that was the only reason that they decided to do a cesarean, is that it was a meconium and not the positioning, or was it the combination of the two?
It was the combination of the two, but I would say it's more the meconium because they didn't know, there was a lot of it and it was really dark, so they didn't know how long it was in there for, and they didn't want to risk her getting, they didn't want to risk her ingesting any of it because obviously that could have been very bad for the baby. And I think for her, it was that, okay, fine, you've labored for 26 hours. You haven't progressed in the last 2 hours from 9 centimeters. There is no room for the baby to move. She didn't have time to explain that to me then, but she's actually told me this because I'm seeing the same gynecologist again. She's actually told me this now during my second pregnancy because I still don't have closure from what happened. As I said, she's not the kind of doctor that or the kind of person that really engages and converses and gives too much information. So I just wanted to get to the bottom of it to get to have closure just in case the second pregnancy does end up in a C-section as well. I want to be emotionally and mentally prepared for it. With Tara, I wasn't because my goal was to avoid the C-section, to have a natural birth, and that's all I focused on. Now my focus is different. My focus is to make sure that I don't have a traumatizing birth experience because I wasn't emotionally ready for whatever outcome and obviously for the baby to be safe. And so I asked her in one of my appointments recently, can you please tell me more about what happened with Tara and why we had to rush into a C-section? And that's when she told me, you know, the baby was too big for your small frame. There wasn't any room for her to move, even though she was in a right occiput transverse position. There's always a chance during labor for the baby to naturally move on its own. And she said that I've delivered so many babies in that position where they started off in a right occiput transverse position, but then they turned as labor progressed. In your case, what probably ended up happening was Tara couldn't turn because there was no space for her to move. And so we just have to get her out because the way that I saw it, there was no hope for another outcome.
It sounds like you had some education about birth going into that first birth. Was that an influence of the doula or was that some research that you had done or the Ina May Gaskin books?
Ina May Gaskin was definitely my teacher when it comes to all this information. And just YouTube, I watched videos of mothers who had doulas, and the doula would, you know, talk about these things during their one-to-ones because you have antenatal appointments with them, I think, twice before you go into labor. My doula also was quite amazing in terms of sharing information as well, but I started working with a doula later on in my pregnancy. So at that point, I had already done enough research and spoke with various women who've given birth. And there's a lovely Facebook community that I'm also a part of. And a lot of the doulas there are also ex-midwives or are currently midwives, and they're just sharing a lot of information. So just through conversing and research, watching videos, listening to interviews, podcasts, watching documentaries, that's how I was able to get a lot of knowledge on birth and also the business of birth as well, which was a huge influence on how and why I wanted to go the natural route as much as possible.
So how was Yusuf feeling, seeing all of this unfold?
Scared. He was very scared. And it was also during a very challenging time for him because lucky for me, I was able to close down the yoga room and sell it before my pregnancy progressed. The restaurant took a little bit longer. And on that day, he had a couple of very important calls set up to kind of close the deal. So during my labor, he was kind of in and out. This is something that I was very angry talking about, but I would say it is one of the very few things about my pregnancy or my delivery story with Tara that I'm now able to speak about comfortably and kind of have closure on, is that Yusuf actually wasn't there when my C-section started. So he missed the birth because he had to go on a call. And at that point, I was still in the pool and I was still progressing through labor. My mom and my doula were there. And he was just like, listen, I really need to go and take this important call. I won't be long. I promise I'll be back really quickly. Don't worry. And I said, yeah, it's fine. I'm here. I'm not going anywhere. The doula's here. My mom's here. Like, you can go. You can leave for a while and come back. But it dragged. The call dragged. And also he was in a different place. He had to leave the hospital building. So he was stuck in rush hour. In Dubai here, you can't get anywhere without driving. So he couldn't make it back in time, unfortunately. And I think that was probably the most difficult thing about the whole thing, is that he wasn't there and that he missed his child's birth. And he wasn't there to kind of hold my hand throughout the C-section and comfort me emotionally. But otherwise, before that, during labor, he was just, you know, as supportive as he can be. There was very little that he knew because he wasn't interested in doing the kind of research that I did. But that's, you know, that's understandable. I was watching women on YouTube give birth, and that wasn't something that he wanted to do. And I can understand that. But whatever the doula would tell him to do, you know, support her back here, rub her thighs here, put this essential oil on her there, and just, you know, saying some really encouraging things to me. He was supportive in that way and it was really nice. And now with the second pregnancy, both him and I feel a little bit more prepared. So I feel a whole lot more comfortable and more confident to have him as a birth partner without having a doula around, for example.
So who was with you at your birth, and then what happened in those next few hours and days after she was born?
Oh, goodness. It was crazy. My mother was with me when I gave birth. So when I was wheeled in for the C-section and Yusuf wasn't around, I didn't even have to ask my mom. They were prepping her and she came into the OR and stayed with me up until Tara was born. And she was the first person to see Tara, because obviously when you have a C-section, they have this sheet and you can't see what's happening. Although I asked them, can you bring the sheet down? I want to see everything. And my doctor looked at me, she said, absolutely not. When they delivered Tara out of my tummy and put her on the table to just make sure that she's fine, clean all the poop off of her and give her to me, my mother was the first person to see her. So my mom is extremely attached to Tara. It is a bond like nothing I've seen. I mean, you think that a mother and daughter's bond is special, but then when you see Tara and my mom's bond, it's crazy. And maybe Tara imprinted on her. I don't know what it is. Maybe that's why. And then after that, they put me in recovery for about 45 minutes. And that's where Yusuf got to meet Tara for the first time. So it's just me and him. We spent some time together. And then when they checked that my vitals were fine and everything was okay, and I was ready to go to my room, and I stayed in the hospital for, I think, 4 nights and 5 days. I remember because I was in bed. I was in the bed with Tara. I was holding Tara. And they were wheeling me to my room. And the minute the elevator door opened, the first people in my face were my brother and my father-in-law. And I was like, okay. Then I get wheeled into my room, and my room's, it's a small room. It's just big enough for a hospital bed, a sofa, and a TV, and that's it. And everyone was there. My sister-in-law, my mother-in-law, my husband's cousin, my dad was there. The family was there. And it was crazy because all I could think of was, I smell really bad. I look really bad. I'm bleeding. I'm in pain, even though I still have the spinal tap inside me. And, you know, and I was overwhelmed, and I wanted some space and I wanted some time for myself. And I think, I don't know how it is in other cultures, but in our culture, as soon as you give birth, everyone's there to congratulate you and to give you gifts. And I just, for the first 2 days, didn't have a moment of silence or privacy. Nothing. I didn't have a moment to myself because there's always someone coming in to say congratulations, whether it was friends or ex-colleagues or family, extended families. For 2 days, it was quite crazy. And I just wanted to have some time with my child, bond with my child, have some skin to skin, because I couldn't have immediate skin to skin because of the C-section. They put her on me, luckily, while they were stitching me up. But it wasn't the kind of skin to skin that I would have had if it was a vaginal delivery or a natural birth. And obviously, I was also breastfeeding Tara, so it was quite a struggle, obviously, especially when there were people around. And when there were a lot of men in the room, it was really funny. I didn't really care. I mean, I would look at my breasts. It was like, okay, this is a source of food for my daughter. It's nothing else anymore. But the minute they know that I need to breastfeed, they leave the room. And we're talking about like 5 men trying to get up and make space to get out of the room. So, and it would take them a couple minutes to get out, and it's a huge ordeal. And they're just standing outside waiting for me to finish, then come back in the room. So it was just not the best, but I mean, it was amazing to have family around. It was really nice to see that everybody was very happy and wanted to show me love, wanted to show my family love, my daughter love. But all I really wanted was just to be by myself with my husband and my daughter. And that's that.
Tell us a little bit about what your recovery from the cesarean was like.
Physical or emotional recovery?
Both.
You know, the physical recovery was actually not that bad, because for the first 10 days, you're given ibuprofen in case you need to take any painkillers. I think I suffered more with the emotional recovery than the physical. Now, with the C-section, that part of your abdomen never feels the same. It always feels different. And I even feel it now as my pregnancy progressed and my belly started to grow. I actually felt quite a bit of tenderness around my scar. But anyway, before the pregnancy and as I was healing after delivering Tara, it wasn't so bad. There was always a way to manage the physical pain because I think I was too distracted by the emotional trauma that I had. That was difficult for me. So I had this idea of after giving birth that I would stay home for 40 days, bond with the child, and kind of just not figure out a routine, but have some kind of a flow in place of breastfeeding, sleeping, napping, etc. And because I just couldn't handle the pain that I was feeling from not being able to deliver naturally, emotional pain, I remember leaving the hospital after 5 days and thinking, I need to be out of the house as much as possible to distract me from that feeling. Now, on the one hand, I was very sad. But on the other hand, I had my child and I loved her so much. And the love was just so overwhelming. And it was the only thing that really put me in a good mood. It was the only thing that got me out of the sadness that I was feeling from not being able to deliver naturally. But I suffered through that for 18 months and I kept quiet for the longest time. And it was in a very pleasant space, a headspace to be in, especially when you were having dark thoughts. And it was very difficult to balance because, as I said, my child made me happy, but I was also having some really dark thoughts. I considered suicide. I was just not in a good place and nobody really prepared me for that. They talked about the baby blues, but they didn't talk about postpartum depression or postpartum anxiety. And I didn't have anyone to talk about it. And at that point, you know, Yusuf was working full time, just trying to get his life on track and be a dad and be happy. And I guess it's something that he didn't notice. And I don't blame him. I should have opened up, but it took me 18 months to open up, which was very difficult. But it was such a relief to then talk about it because then something could have been done. And, you know, when you start telling people like your husband, like your friends, listen, this is what I've been feeling. These are the thoughts that I've been having. And I just wanted to open up and tell you. A lot of people were very understanding. My mom didn't take it very well. When I told her that I think I have postpartum depression, she looked at me and she was quite upset for me to say something like that. She said, how could you say that you're depressed when you have the most beautiful, precious miracle in your hands? And that made me feel really bad as well. But it took me a while to understand that how I felt had nothing, how I felt about postpartum, you know, the postpartum depression, anxiety, the sadness, the dark thoughts had nothing to do with the child that I have because I love her. And that was the only thing that was really keeping me sane and probably stopping me from doing some crazy things.
So is that a feeling that you had immediately after birth and then it continued? Or was it something that sort of over time you started to notice more?
No, I started to notice it more over time. In the beginning, maybe it was difficult to make sense of it because, as I said, I didn't have a moment to myself to think, to process. There was always a distraction if people visiting, family being around. For the first 3 weeks, I stayed at my parents' place. And, you know, they kept me distracted quite often. But it was only when I moved back home and I was alone with Tara in so many cases, during the sleepless nights or after nursing her and putting her down and her crying because she wanted to be carried. And I just didn't understand why she still needed me, why she wanted me. And all I wanted was just, can I please just have 5 minutes? I remember like talking to a 5 month or 3 month old thinking at saying to her, I just want 5 minutes to myself. Can you please leave me alone? And there she is crying. Like, obviously she doesn't understand what I'm saying. And it took a while for me to, you know, snap out of it and realize that everything that I'm feeling is not her fault. And so I needed to stop taking it out on her.
So what was the turnaround point for you? You said at 18 months you started to feel differently or you realized that you might have something going on. So what was the turnaround point?
So the first person that I opened up to was my mom, and it was quite early on, not at the 18-month mark. And it was the way that she reacted that made me feel like I should stop telling people how I feel, because if this is the kind of reaction that I'm going to get, then obviously I'm wrong to feel this way, which is not the case. You're not wrong to feel that way. It happens. It's hormonal. It's emotional. It's mental. What you have to do is open up and talk about it. And what the turnaround point for me was when people started to accept and acknowledge how I felt and told me that it was completely okay. I hated it when people said it was normal. But I loved it when people said, it's okay, and I understand. And then people started to just make me feel like it was safe to talk, to just, you know, without even breaking down, being able to say like, oh, today's not a good day. And just to be able to make that declaration, to make that statement, and people acknowledge and understand, it was really relieving. And just being able to talk about it more and more over time. And then I stopped feeling it.
Were you breastfeeding?
I recently stopped breastfeeding, actually. I was breastfeeding full time and I decided to stop. a month before Tara's third birthday, because that's when Yusuf and I decided that we were ready to start trying for a second child. You know, if anything, one thing that made me also recover from the whole experience, whether it's the postpartum anxiety or the C-section and not being able to have the delivery that I wanted, was the fact that I celebrated being able to breastfeed and to breastfeed as long as I did as a huge accomplishment, because I did it also while teaching. And so obviously I planned my whole life around her breastfeeding schedule. I've said no to opportunities and to classes because they coincided with the time that I needed to breastfeed Tara. That was early on in postpartum journey. But then later, as our feeding schedule kind of regulated and she was not feeding as frequently and I was able to pump and have someone feed her with the bottle instead of being around, and I started to take on more clients, take on more responsibilities, teach more classes. But it was definitely something that I celebrated and I loved it. Not once did I hate breastfeeding. In the very beginning, it was painful, which is expected, but I absolutely loved it. And I even loved that she would wake up in the middle of the night to breastfeed. And that continued up until she was 2.5 to 3 years old. She never stopped waking up in the middle of the night for some comfort or for some breast milk.
It's definitely something you can have, you know, a natural conception and a uncomplicated pregnancy and breastfeed as a mother that's had a cesarean. You can really hold yourself to that one moment or that one day, really, that things didn't go according to plan when everything else has been so smooth and effortless.
Of course. Look, I'm by nature a planner, and I find it very difficult to accept situations when they don't go according to plan. And that's part of my perfectionist personality. So I planned a natural birth, and I also planned on breastfeeding. And the main reason, one of the main reasons that I planned on breastfeeding and for as long as I did, was because just before giving birth to Tara, I decided to become vegan and also chose to raise her based on vegan principles as well. And so we didn't have access to vegan formula over here. You can still get it one way or another, but it's quite difficult, and I didn't have it on hand. And in any case, I just felt like, you know what, if I'm able to produce breast milk, and if it was easy for me to feed, and if it didn't have any emotional effect on me, then I should be able to continue. I didn't think that breast is best, fed is best always, but I was very, very lucky that I had a great supply of milk. And due to being a vegan also, I just didn't want to give her a non-vegan formula, for example. So a bit of stubbornness had a huge role in also how long I was able to breastfeed Tara for.
So talk to us about your return to your yoga practice. At what point did you decide to get back on the mat?
So based on the many books that I've read, whether it's Yoga Sadhana or some of the books or the book that Patabi Joyce wrote or whatever Sharat has said in conference, ideally, I would have waited 6 months before I started practicing, but I didn't. At my six-week appointment, my doctor gave me the green light to start doing yoga, but I guess she had no idea what kind of practice I was doing, and maybe her interpretation of yoga was, you know, it was an easier kind of form of exercise. I waited 2 more weeks, so I would say that I first started 2 months postpartum, and I started off with sun salutations for a little bit, but then as I started to slowly build the strength, and I was doing some rehab work, I remember following a challenge that Kino was running on social media, and it was about strengthening the shoulders, strengthening the your core, your pelvic floor, and also bringing some mobility into it. So I thought, okay, this is great. I can do this because obviously I'm quite weak right now compared to how I was pre-pregnancy. And I also am very tight from just holding my baby all day long and breastfeeding her all day long as well. So I was doing that in addition to my regular, very basic practice like Surya Namaskar and standing sequence. But I think it was once I reached 4 months postpartum, I started to go to classes, and I was going to led classes. The Mysore classes were not, the timings weren't suitable for me back then. And I didn't have I didn't feel like doing my self-practice at home. I just really wanted to be around people. So I was going to led classes, and that probably wasn't a good idea because then I started to rush into doing the full primary. By the time I was 5 months postpartum, I was having the teacher help me during led class in Dropbox because it was a small class. It was like 11 in the morning, so not many people were attending. And I just took advantage and said, could you just like help me build my drop back practice back again? Just help me drop back and pick me back up. And that really wasn't a good idea because I rushed into it. My body was not ready for it. And I ended up having a lot of back pain from it as well. So I took a step back and just changed my whole mentality around it. Started to go to Mysore programs again with Natalie, I would say maybe 8 months postpartum. And so I used to alternate between Natalie because Natalie's Mysore program is quite a drive from where I live. But then I found another Mysore program that started closer to where I live that was run by Ethan and Charmel. They're younger authorized teachers, but they are a wealth of knowledge. And it was such a breath of fresh air practicing with them. They had beautiful energy. They were very interested in also the healing journey of the practice rather than just throwing asanas in my face and getting the practice done. And I would say with them is when and how I really found my love and passion again for the physical practice. And I was able to really heal, build strength, enjoy practicing, enjoy breathing, enjoy moving. And you know what? I never said this to them or to anyone. I think this is the first time I make the statement, but they really helped me get out of the postpartum funk that I was in.
So how did you make your practice work at that time? Were you doing some practice at home and how often were you going to their classes?
You know, it really depended on my schedule. Every month was different for me in terms of, because when I started to just freelance teaching yoga, I wasn't running my own Mysore program. I had privates mainly and a few classes in studios here and there. And with privates, days and times are always changing. Sometimes they cancel last minute. And, you know, when you have a child, you have to always plan who's going to look after the child. Like I said, Yusuf works full time. He has an office job, so he needs to be out of the house at a certain point. My in-laws live nearby, so whenever I needed to, I could just drop Tada off to them. My mother works full time as well, but she was able to come and look after Tada in the afternoons or in the evenings. So I really worked around my schedule for quite some time to see how I can balance practicing at home and going to the shala a couple of times a week. But then I would say maybe when Tara was a year and a half, I was able to go to the shala on a daily basis, especially when I started to practice with Ethan and Charmel because they were a 5-minute drive from home. So it's just so much easier for me to leave the house quite early in the morning. You know, I'd wake up at 6 a.m., breastfeed Tara, is like her morning feed. She'd go back to sleep. Yusuf would still be at home. I would make arrangements with my in-law's nanny and she would come over for a couple of hours and look after Tara while I was practicing. Then I would come back and I just managed. But then I think it was after I went to Mysore last year. I went to Mysore with Tara, which was a dream come true. And again, being there kind of worked its magic on me. And then I came back to Dubai. And I was able to just practice at home on my own, didn't feel like I needed to go back to the shala, but if I felt like I needed to be around people, then I would attend classes here and there. So I've been practicing at home since then.
So what does your practice look like now? Oh yeah, sorry. Actually, no, you're pregnant again. It's changed again, hasn't it?
It has, yes. My last trip to Mysore last year, March 2019, as I said, I was working up to Kapotasana with Sharat, but my teacher in Greece, Sabas, gave me up to Bakasana B. So I was working up to Bakasana B. And so basically what that meant was full primary and then work up to Bakasana B. But there were some days where I would do half primary. I didn't have much time to practice because I needed to be at work or something like that. Because most days I managed to get my full practice in. But there's always the odd day here and there where I would just do Surya Namaskar and finishing sequence. But now that I'm pregnant, I'm having to modify. I'm doing whatever modifications I can for primary and whatever modifications I can for second. And I'm adding a few things here and there that help me feel good to open up the front of the body a little bit. So I'll do some pigeon pose, deep lunges that I hold for a while. But in addition to my yoga practice, just to kind of help me on a physical level, because, you know, as the years have progressed, I definitely still benefit from the physical aspect of the practice, but it is definitely more of a mental practice for me right now. And it's just become part of my daily habit. It's almost like waking up in the morning, drinking a glass of water, brushing your teeth, having your coffee, get on your mat and practice. It's kind of like the routine that I have in place. And if one thing in that routine doesn't happen, then I feel off. And so that's what my practice has become for me. But to help me with this pregnancy feel a bit stronger, and just also feel better in the body. I've been going to the gym twice a week just to add in some lightweight training. And I'm also working with a PT who does some very interesting work on activating certain muscles and creating space in the front of the body, especially because, you know, I had told her that I had pelvic girdle syndrome with my first pregnancy. So we do some really funky things like holding squats for a long time, or just really focusing on the movement of the squats, only body weight, or just pulling my tongue out and moving it from side to side and seeing how that releases the pelvic floor or how it creates space in the ribs. I don't understand it. And at first I was very skeptical, but I'm so fascinated by it because I do it with her and I actually see it work and I feel great in my body. The only thing that doesn't feel good about this pregnancy is the constant nausea that I have.
How have you found the journey of parenting now that Tara is a little bit older?
I absolutely love being a parent. It has brought so much joy to my life and more meaning, more purpose than anything I've ever done. I think Tara is a very special child, and I might be biased because I'm her mom, but I also see how she is with other people, with the extended family, with strangers. She's just such a beautiful person. She brings so much light into people's lives. So that is just, it's such an honor to be the mother of her, of this child who brings so much happiness to people. So that's why I found parenting to be honestly one of the most beautiful things, but also one of the most difficult things, because the love that I have for her is so overwhelming. And I'm constantly, constantly worried about her one way or another. She's by no means a perfect child because there is no such thing. You know, she still throws her tantrums. She could be difficult with food. She has her mother's attitude. So she's a very stubborn girl and speaks her mind and will do whatever she can to get her way. And so obviously in these times, I really have to be patient and understand that she is growing into her own person and developing her personality, and that, and I should nurture that. Obviously, still teach her that there are ways to do things. You have to be polite. You have to ask nicely, et cetera, et cetera. But I never want to change who she is and how she thinks, because she's a beautiful person. She's her own person. But I have to be very patient, and you know, remember that when she's throwing a tantrum, instead of screaming and threatening and saying, "I'm going to put you in the naughty timeout chair in the corner," I have to just understand that she's expressing her feelings. She's navigating through these emotions, trying to understand it. So there definitely are very difficult moments and some challenges to overcome as a parent. You know, when it's a child like Tara and how amazing she is, it makes it easier. And I have a beautiful support system. My husband is head over heels in love with her, which is something that none of us would have thought would happen, because He didn't want children. And it was only later in our relationship that he was like, "Okay, I think I'm ready to start a family." And we all knew that he would be a great dad, but the fantastic dad that he is, the love that he has for Tara, like, it surprises me on a daily basis, because it's just so beautiful to watch, and they have a beautiful bond together. So to have a partner who's also very supportive, very involved, very in love with his child to a great extent is also a great thing to have to navigate through the journey of parenting.
And has yoga helped you through parenting and some of the challenges?
Of course. And it did take a while. If anything, the yoga practice has retaught me and reminded me how to breathe throughout everything, which is really important. And also, you know, the yoga practice is something that's unique to me and special. It's not something that I share with my husband. You know, he's not a yoga practitioner. He's attended classes here and there to indulge me, but it's not something that we do together on a daily basis, like many Mysore couples, for example. So it is my thing and it is my special thing, and I get to share it a lot with my daughter. So she's been part of many classes that I've taught. She's been part of my yoga videos on social media. She is practicing with me almost on a daily basis, but kind of having fun and exploring. And it's just really nice to share that practice. And it brings me a lot of joy. You know, the yoga practice is something that I absolutely love and has helped me in so many stages of my life. And to now see my daughter being a part of it, it makes the practice that much more enjoyable as well.
You also share on your social media that you're a vegan. Have you also been parenting your daughter as a vegan as well?
Yes, that is correct. I am a vegan and I have been parenting her as a vegan. It is a decision that I took quite early on. And as a matter of fact, like I said, during my pregnancy, I was a vegetarian. So I was lacto-ovo. And I had a conversation with my husband and I said, I think I want to just raise her on a 100% plant-based diet and, give her the tools to then decide on her own what she wants to be and how she wants to live her life. And he was understanding. But as I started to move towards a vegan lifestyle and became super passionate about animal rights and also living plant-based, being eco-conscious and sustainable with my choices, not just on food, but products that we use at home or even beauty products, nappies, you name it, it's a whole lifestyle. Becoming vegan became a gateway to all these different changes and approaches in our life. My husband is not, but he is extremely supportive of me raising Tara, maybe not as part of the vegan lifestyle, but just feeding her very nutritious and healthy food. She's 3 years old right now, and I try to be very careful with what I teach her as far as vegan principles go, because the reality is most people that surround her are not vegan and consume a lot of animal products and maybe don't have the same mentality that I do. And my intention is not to say that they are wrong or that they are bad people, because I don't ever want her to think that her grandparents or her father are not good people because they eat animal products or use products that are different from the products that we use. I just want to show her and in sharing it on social media, hopefully inspire both my immediate circle and, the strangers that are part of this social media community, that there is a different way of living, and that children, they are born naturally compassionate people that don't want to cause any harm to any living thing or even to the world that we live in. So it's been an interesting learning journey for me, because I know what's important to me. I know what the vegan principles are, the principles of the vegan lifestyle. And now being a parent and wanting to pass that on to my child, I also want to be careful in how I do that. We read a lot of books, and I'm also very honest with her. If there's something that somebody puts on the table that isn't vegan and she would want to reach for it, I would just be honest with her and say, I'm sorry, mommy can't give you that because it isn't vegan. And mommy doesn't feel comfortable doing that. And she understands that. So I'm trying not to say you're not allowed to eat this because it's not vegan, because I still want it to be a choice that she makes. I don't want to force her to be a vegan. I'm going to continue raising her based on the principles of veganism. I'm going to continue feeding her plant-based foods. I care about her nutrition. I care about her well-being. That comes first. In the same way, I also care about the world that we live in, the impact that we have on it. I care about the animals, and it's a great reason why I am vegan. And she's starting to say things like, I don't eat chicken, I don't eat eggs. And when we ask her, she says, because I'm vegan. Now, how much of it does she understand? I'm not sure. But it's really cute to see a three-year-old say things like that. Or sometimes, we'd be out in a restaurant, she'd look at her dad and say, Daddy, is your food vegan? And if he would say, no, it's not, she would just kind of say, okay. She wouldn't ask for it. So it's very interesting to see how smart children can be or how they make associations. I'm not sure how long this is going to last for, but let's see.
Final question. What's your preparation for your next birth?
At the moment, I don't have any. I want to change doctors. And I'm exploring other options. So that's the first thing that I want to do. My husband and I have talked a lot about Labor Day when it comes. I don't know if I'm going to end up having a C-section or not. We need to see how the pregnancy progresses before the gynecologist can decide if I can go ahead with trying for a VBAC or not. But the plan is to have a VBAC.
I think that's a common misconception that people believe that if you've already had one cesarean, you automatically have a second cesarean, but there is the vaginal birth after cesarean or attempting to at least have a trial of labor and then going down that path.
Exactly, exactly. That's what I want to try. So one of the things that my current gynecologist told me was to make sure that I watch my weight. Now with Tara, I gained 17 kilos, but that to me is just a number, because honestly, I was active during pregnancy and I ate quite healthy food. Obviously, I indulged here and there every now and then, but and the weight gain was, I retain a lot of water as well. But I am keeping that in mind, and I am sort of doing everything that I can to make sure that the weight gain is steady and that I gain within the average range. I don't know if that makes a difference. I'm just trying to follow as much advice given to me as possible to maybe have a better chance of having a successful VBAC. And I also think that changing doctors would really help, because one of the things that I struggled with my doctor is the minimal communication. I'm going to just see how the pregnancy progresses and hope for the best, but I'll also keep an open mind as well, so that if I do end up in a planned or an emergency C-section, that it's not emotionally traumatizing for me, because I need to accept that this is a possibility. And in the end of the day, you know, any way that you give birth is a way of giving birth, whether it's planned or emergency C-section, whether it's vaginal with epidural, you know, you name the different ways of giving birth. It's always a difficult thing for a mom to do, no matter the method. What I'm doing differently now is that I have accepted that any way of giving birth is going to be a good way, because you're bringing your child into the world. And as long as your child is safe, then that matters. It also matters that you are happy and that you are in a good emotional state postpartum. So I think just changing my mindset, instead of saying I have to have a natural delivery or I would have failed as a mom, I would have failed as a woman, that mindset is going to make it so much more possible for me to maybe not have the same emotional and mental trauma that I had the first time around. So I plan on going up to 40 weeks. I don't want to induce early. And I'll just, you know, do all the natural things that people talk about, eat all the pineapple and drink all the red raspberry tea leaf and walk as much as I can. Sometimes even doing all these things might not end you in the labor and delivery scenario that you want. And also what was really amazing about having our first child is that it brought me and Yusuf closer to one another and has really had a beautiful impact on our marriage and our relationship. We are so much closer. There's so much more to bond over right now. And so I feel just having that beautiful relationship also with a person as your birth partner would be really great. So I'm just, you know, in the end of the day, I'm only hoping for the best for everyone.
We'll have to get you back on to hear how this next birth goes.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
So if people want to connect with you, what's the best way that they can get in touch?
They can reach me on social media if they wanted. They can follow me at Jumana Yoga, and I do respond to direct messages.
Well, thanks very much for joining us, and we wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really good to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to this episode. Jumana's Instagram and other links mentioned will be in the show notes and on the website seventhseries.net. To keep up to date with new episodes as they're released, subscribe through your favourite channels, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and more. Support the podcast and help us reach more people by rating and reviewing the podcast and sharing the podcast through your socials. Please join me again for another episode of the Seventh Series podcast.